Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we are back live at our normal time, broadcasting both on Progressive Radio Network in our studios, New York, where we originate our programs, and also simultaneously live on our sister station, WBAI, and WPFW in Washington, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and many other stations all over the world. And that's good, because it was a real combined effort on the part of Grayson Challenger and the engineering staff at WBAI. And what we've done, at least temporarily, for the WBAI audience, we have established an emergency studio, self-contained, with its own 24/7 access and broadcasting that will launch right now as we speak. Hopefully there won't be too many glitches, and that way, once the major Wall Street office opens, they're able to return, but at least they won't be off the air, and that's what's important. So for all those who've helped do this, we appreciate your input. Now, today on this program, I'm going to share the latest on health and healing and why all those experiments with millions of animals and chimpanzees and monkeys, they're really not accurate, and I'll explain that. Then, from our science section, I'm going to share the latest analysis of the current flu vaccine and how it came up without efficacy. Yesterday, we filmed one of the world's leading immunologists, and this was that first day we had to get permission from the university where she's a professor, and then we had to give all our questions, but finally, we got it in the can. I will be streaming this interview because it is so important prior to the actual documentary. The film is 100% finished, what we call pre-production and production, meaning my filming, traveling throughout the world to film all these people on the subject of vaccinations, is done. Now we go into post-production. That'll take about 5 months. So sometime in the late spring, we will premiere this. And all the people in the film are women, medical doctors, victims, and scientists. But she is really unique because her reputation is unassailable. She is one of the world's leading immunologists. And you will hear her describe how, in a very direct way, so there was no ambiguity, no confusion, no wiggle worm, no spin. I simply ask, can any individual take a vaccine, one or more, and be determined that they will be protected from the vaccine side effects or protected from the disease that they're being vaccinated for? And the answer is no. Now, since the entire foundation of vaccination rests upon the idea that when you are vaccinated, you are immunized, then that takes into account, well, then how much are we immunized? What percentage are we immunized? Over what period of time are we immunized? And then what happens when that immunity runs off and we have to get a booster shot? And how do we know we need it? And then what happens to the effects of that vaccine in our bloodstream? What does that do to our natural immunity? What does it do to an baby's non-developed immunity, a child's non-developed immunity, a sick person's immunity? All of these are the questions that were asked. And in the most precise manner, she addressed each with supporting documentation, because we explained in advance, every single person in the film must have full scientific documentation that will withstand critical analysis and even to the degree of cross-examination under forensic science in a court of law. So when you see people in my film, you will also see in B-roll the documentation to support them. So we have the truth on our side, the vaccine industry, the pharmaceutical company, the CDC, the National Institutes of Health. They do not. So what I can say at this time is the American public have been duped into pseudoscientific belief that this will actually protect them. The question is, there is no ability to predict who would be protected and who would not be protected. And so that is now done. In our analysis from Dr. Joseph Mercola from Health News Impact, I will give you the latest on the flu vaccine and its lack of efficacy. But most importantly today, after reading all the different pundits, all the different supporters of President Obama on the left, the people who said they had to hold their nose and vote, well, you wouldn't have had to hold your nose had you voted for the people who would not have compromised on issues important to the American public. This is a commentary for them. You have heard time and again that the moment someone raises the issue that there are conspiracies, that from Keith Urban and Rachel Maddow and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, they all say, no, no, no. Today, I will prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that virtually everything in the business community at large is based upon a small group of companies who have inordinate power over the entire world. This will be completely referenced. The commentary from Andrew Gavin Marshall at .com. I was up late last night writing, and you will have a chance after this commentary to call in and share your points of view, because I will try to predict what is the likely outcome of the next 4 years in the United States for the average person. So I'm setting aside a lot of time for that. Also from our environmental segment today, Superstorm Sandy. It provided a powerful case for revisiting Fukushima and the real dangers of nuclear energy from natural disasters. And more on genetic engineering. In this case of canola, the proof that it will destroy crops and land in Oregon's Willamette Valley. So we have a lot to talk about. Let's begin. As a scientist who's done an awful lot of experiments, hundreds in clinical studies with humans, over 47, I have never seen the need to harm, injure, create pain, or kill a single animal. It is not necessary. But virtually all the major scientific institutions and universities around the United States use millions of animals every year. Now this study from Science Daily. It was from a professor Gilad in human genetics at the University of Chicago. And it said, quote, humans and chimpanzees and monkeys share DNA, but not gene regulatory mechanisms. That's the key. We do not share gene regulatory mechanisms. Let me quote this. Humans share over 90% of their DNA with their primate cousins. The expression or activity of patterns of genes differ across species in ways that help explain each species' distinct biology and behavior. DNA factors that contribute to the differences were described at the American Society of Human Genetics meeting in a presentation by Dr. Gilad. He reported that up to 40% of the differences in the expression of or activity patterns of genes between humans, chimpanzees, and rhesus monkeys can be explained by regulatory mechanisms that determine whether and how a gene's will affect a protein is transcribed to the RNA molecule that carries the recipe instructions to the site of the cells. Now, what does this mean in lay language? What this tells me, and should tell the scientific community, is that when you do an experiment on a monkey, like a rhesus monkey or a chimpanzee, what they tried to do, for example, with trying to create AIDS in chimpanzees, they could not. They were not able to do it. Think of all the ones that were sacrificed. And then, only by giving them chemotherapy and destroying their immune system. Then the symptoms, they said, were similar to those of AIDS. Well, that is a fraudulent study. The people doing that study should be brought up on crimes against humanity. Because think of the consequences of saying you have insight, and therefore you're creating protocols and drugs to help people, but your underlying science is itself flawed. You can no longer trust that what was done in chimpanzees and monkeys could automatically reflect what would happen in a human ape because, quote, though we share DNA, we do not share gene regulatory mechanisms. So when you give a drug or you give anything to a primate, its regulatory mechanisms, which are uniquely different than a human's, would nullify the outcome. That's just an important point I wanted to share on that because I'm really concerned that we just don't seem to learn anything from science. It is better to exercise, we think, when we're well, but we're not sure whether we should exercise when we're sick. Now, in medical news, they have a study from Loyola University Health System medical doctor, and he's suggesting the following, quote, we all know that exercise is key to good health, but there are times that your body may need a break. Having to slow down when you're sick is Mother Nature's way of saying, don't push it, and it's reasonable to pay attention to that. I would absolutely agree with that, and I would say here are the areas where I would not exercise. If you have a fever, diarrhea, vomiting, shortness of breath, chest congestion, dizziness, lightheaded, like headaches, or you have body aches. Now, so what you could do if you feel that your body system is weak, you've overworked, you're stressed, go for a nice power walk and allow your body to breathe. Get out into the open air. Allow your mind to exhale and relax. Do some yoga. There are various forms of yoga. Some are very passive, some are more active. Do the more active form. Also, deep breathing exercises when you feel yourself becoming sick. And that way you're not overburdening the immune system. If you've ever watched a dog, a cat, a monkey, I'll go out to my where I have the beautiful enclosure where I have some primates that I have rescued and given to me, and I get them back to health, or they've been abused, which is more often the case, and you get them back to trusting and loving, and you suddenly see the patterns, and the patterns are very specific. Lots of energy, bouncing, playing all the time, and suddenly you see one of them is not moving. They're just sitting there. That's immediately a sign that says their body has been affected. Now, you don't know what's wrong. You don't know, is it parasitic or is it bacterial? Is it injury? So when you rule out injury, then you realize they have to rest. And then you have to give them lots of bonding, hugging, cuddling. Give them bottles, baby bottles filled with special and powerful healing nutrients to stimulate antiviral, antibacterial, antiparasitic action, 10, 15 times more garlic than normal. And within about a 24-hour cycle, you'll see it change. What's interesting is when a primate, any primate, I've raised chimpanzees, Kokomo Jr., and all forms of other primates, when they are sick, they revert back, much like people do, to almost an infant stage. They want to be cuddled. They want to look in your eyes. They want that reassurance. They want that feeling of being able to touch their face. They'll grab with their little fingers. They grab your finger and they hold on to it. It's their security. They get a little, every primate has its own security, a toy or blanket. Normally it's a blanket, a little blanket. And everywhere they go, they got it with them. They carry it in their tail, and or a teddy bear. They love their teddy bears. And at night, they'll cover their entire body like in a cocoon. They wrap themselves up. And then in the morning, you'll see little fingers pull back, and you see these little tiny faces, cute little face with these big eyes. They look out at the world, and they know it's right to start the day. But until they recover, they absolutely go to a very restful place. We should do the same. Look at a dog or cat that's sick. They try to escape to a quiet place, more often than not a dark place. They frequently eat grass beforehand. And what's interesting is if in the grass you have bitters, if you have a sorrel, which is good for them, or wild onions, shallots, they'll use that, or dandelion greens, absolutely, they will eat that first. Because their instinct tells them there is something in that chemistry that will help rid the body of whatever is impacting them. And then when they start to recover their energy, they return. So imagine now you're getting sick, you're overworked, you're stressed, and you start to push yourself. Then you really can take a tumble with your immune system. Good news for those of you who use your leisure time with physical activity. According to the National Institutes of Health, the newest study out there, you've just extended your life expectancy by almost 5 years. Let me quote from PLOS Medicine. Leisure time physical activity is associated with longer life expectancy, even at relatively low levels of activity, and regardless of body weight, according to researchers led by the National Cancer Institute and the National Institutes of Health. They looked at 650,000 adults. Average age was 40 or older. So what they're asking is, if you do a minimum of 2.5 hours of moderate exercise, 1.5 hours of vigorous exercise per week, then you're going to have about 4.5 years extra life on. I'm suggesting that if you did approximately 7 hours of moderate exercise and 3 hours of vigorous exercise, you could increase that to 10 years. Now, there are other things that will increase your life expectancy also, like being a vegan. A healthy vegan will extend it by 10 years. So there's 20 years. 20 years onto the life expectancy. So again, don't just, you know, you can combine things. For example, in the daytime, I'll take a break and I'll just go for a nice fast walk through Central Park. You walk around the park, you walk by the museum, museums actually, one on the west side, the History Museum, Natural History Museum, and then the Metropolitan Museum of Art on the east side. But just that art of getting into the open air, getting yourself out into nature, being in a positive mood. It's leisure time, but you're exercising, and that's important. And finally, starchy, high-carbohydrate diets, the kind that many people know they shouldn't have, you're more likely to have a recurrence of colon cancer. From the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, quote, colon cancer survivors whose diet is heavy in complex sugars and carbohydrate-rich foods are far more likely to have a reoccurrence of the disease than are patients who eat a better balance of foods. Well, why? It's simple. Refined carbohydrates end up breaking down into your body into simple sugars. But also, they are processed in a way that makes them, whether bagel or toast or bread, makes them very difficult to digest. And in the process of heating the carbohydrate, even a sugar-coated cereal, that ends up creating what are called acrylamides. And an abundance of acrylamides and sugars in the intestine cause inflammation. The inflammation then can cause cancer. That's why you want the fruits into the diet. They help cleanse the intestine, lessening your likelihood of having cancer and lowering your blood pressure and lowering your cholesterol level. Now from our science section today, we have the flu season. It's here. and all the people in the media are telling us, and the health agencies, get your flu shot, right? Even the pharmacies are telling you, just come right in and we'll have a pharmacist come and give you a vaccination. And they're showing you why it's good to get the vaccines. But Dr. Joseph Marcola tells you that you better be concerned about the myths that they're sharing. Quote, it's the time of year when you should be thinking about flu vaccination for yourself and your family, they write. Some people, however, decide not to get the flu vaccine and put themselves and others at risk of getting sick just because they believe that long-held myths about vaccines' danger. End quote. Okay. Well, here's a question. Are vaccine claims based upon real science? According to Dr. Marcola, quote, the only myth here is the unscientific claim that the flu vaccine is safe and effective and the best way to protect yourself against the flu. Nothing could be further from the truth. Numerous studies have shown that the flu vaccine is not, I underline, repeat, not an effective way to prevent influenza, and the real-life experience of vaccine victims offer a window into the indisputable reality that flu vaccines are not without serious risk. Most recently, a University of Minnesota study published in January found that flu vaccines may not offer as much protection as previously thought. The elderly, in particular, do not appear to receive measurable value for the flu shot, which is the same conclusion reached by several previous studies. Trivalent, inactivated influenza vaccines also did not offer much protection to children over the age of 7. So, the study differs from other meta-analysis in that it assessed efficacy and effectiveness and safety of licensed influenza vaccines in the U.S. by including only those studies that use sensitive and highly specific diagnostic tests to confirm case of influenza. So, in essence, if you're a senior, you're taking a health risk for a theoretical health benefit that can't be confirmed. And if you're a healthy adult, it's a shot in the dark. According to this analysis, at best, you'll have about a 59% protection if the selected type A or B influenza strains included in the vaccine are exactly those you happen to be exposed to. And there's absolutely no proof of that. Now, there are some countries that are banning the flu vaccine. Novartis's flu vaccine is now banned in several countries following particle contamination. It all began just a few weeks ago when vaccine maker Crucell, a unit of the U.S. drug maker Johnson & Johnson, suspended delivery of 2.3 million doses of their seasonal flu vaccine, Inflexol V, destined for Italy and other European countries. A week later, on October 24th, Italy banned the sale and use of 4 flu vaccines manufactured by Novartis. The Italian health minister issued an advisory stating that use of the Agrippol, Fluad, and Influpazi in adjuvanted vaccines was suspended until further notice when they found white particles in the vaccine. So, who banned Novartis flu vaccine? Switzerland, Spain, Germany, Austria, France, and Canada. But, of course, not the United States. I'm Gary Nall. Those are health and nutrition and science update. Now, a few issues involving our environment. Then we'll take a break and come back with a commentary. Then we'll open up the lines for you to have an opportunity to talk back. According to Ethan Huff of Natural News, Oregon, a court has created a temporary hold on genetically modified canola plantings after determining the crop will cause, quote, irreparable harm, end quote, to important growing region. So here we have the efforts by the biotechnology industry to begin planting genetically modified canola, also known as rapeseed, in Oregon's prize Willamette Valley, and those have been thwarted, at least temporarily, thanks to the persistent opposition from farmers and farmer advocacy groups. The Oregonian reports that the Oregon Court of Appeals has temporarily halted a ruling by the Oregon Department of Agriculture that would have allowed plantings of the controversial crop at the borders of the highly protected Willamette Valley as soon as this fall. So that's a good victory for us. Now, why don't we go back and take a look at Chernobyl and the cleanup? And why am I doing this? Because I keep hearing that there is no long-term problems from Fukushima, and I'm saying that's not true. Here's the truth of it. From the University of California, as published in Environmental Health Perspectives this week, all right? Chernobyl cleanup workers had significantly increased risk of leukemia, and the findings may help estimate cancer risks from low-dose exposures like CAT scans as well. This was a 20-year study following 110,645 workers who helped to actually clean up the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear power plant accident in the former Soviet territory of Ukraine. And what it does, it shows that the workers share a significant increased risk of developing leukemia. Now, the results can also help scientists better define cancer risks associated with a low dose of radiation from medical diagnostic radiation procedures, such as computed tomography scans or CAT scans. And this is all in the current issue of Environmental Health Perspectives. And why is this important? Because think of all of the workers around the Fukushima plant, and no one is saying, gee whiz, are you at greater risk because you're helping clean up the mess? Now, in Chernobyl, they had a long delay before they really came up with the truth about how bad it was before they got everyone out of the area they should have. They should have evacuated everyone within 300 miles, but they couldn't have done that because then it would have been at Kiev, too large to evacuate at that point. And also, they were still in this, let's not tell the truth, and the world won't know what kind of a mess we're in. With Chernobyl, they still have not evacuated more than 225,000 people living within a very short distance of Fukushima. So that means they're going to be at risk of leukemia and cancers. The workers are going to be at risk of leukemia and cancers. And then it's not that far. What are you talking about? About 157 miles or so? To 40 million people living in Tokyo. And this plant is releasing radiation 24/7, nonstop. And the whole world has just looked the other way. Now, according to Washington Blog and Global Research, we should take a really good look at our own nuclear program. It is my belief that we should close down all 104 nuclear power plants. We should decommission them and take all the spent fuel rods and put them in casks that can be put into a safe environment so they're no longer a risk. None of that is being done. For example, here's what came from Superstorm Sandy that you weren't told. Conditions at three U.S. reactors were virtually similar to what caused the Fukushima disaster. Now, we barely dodged a nuclear crisis from Hurricane Sandy at the Oyster Creek, the Nine Mile, and the Salem plants. For example, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission confirmed loss of power to the fuel pools at Oyster Creek. On October 29th, Oyster Creek declared a notice of unusual event, followed by an alert due to high water levels in the intake structure. Elevated intake structure water levels are of concern, as excessive levels can flood certain plant components and render normal cooling systems inoperable. No safety system was adversely affected by the high intake level, and the site also experienced a loss of off-site power. And both emergency diesel generators started as designed and supplied power to the emergency electrical positions. And then they had to shut down the cooling and the spent fuel cooling. Those were temporarily lost also. So here is the idea. What would have happened if they wouldn't have been able to have got the power back? What if a solar storm and those units came on? Those units are powered by diesel. How much diesel do they have? Enough for a week? The maximum a month? what happens when you're out of diesel? Then you're out of luck. So it's not will we end up having a disaster, it's just when. And I suggest that we start a whole national program to decommission them. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting live today for the first time in 9 days over the Progressive Radio Network and simulcast over our other stations, WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York. And we're happy to see that BAI is getting through its emergency, and they should be normalized so they can have 24/7 live programming just following this show today. So we're all very happy about that till they're able to get back into their regular studios. I believe that having written more than 300 original in-depth investigative reporting articles, all involving conspiracies of some sort or another, that we in the United States have turned a blind eye to the likely outcome of the people in positions of power. And what will they do to either help us as individuals and certainly help the poor, which they haven't at all? You don't ever hear a talk about the poor. You sometimes hear a talk about the middle class or the working class, but not the poor. And we have 100 million of those, one-third of the American population. So what we have done is we've taken a look at the complex systems under which we all live. And here's what we have found, that there are 1,318 companies with ties to two or more other companies. And this core was found to own roughly 80% of the global revenues of the entire 43,000 transnational companies. And then came what the researchers, and these were researchers at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland, discovered. They found that there was a super entity. Now, you haven't heard this before. I'm sharing this because we have to begin to focus on this, that it's not about Obama, or it wouldn't have been about Romney. It's about the people far more powerful than them. I've said many times, I will say it again, you cannot possibly have a president of the United States elected before they are selected. It is the selection. Who makes the selection? How do they groom them? What are they expected to do in return? And everything you've seen shows who is really in control. Well, there's 147 tightly knit companies which all own each other and collectively own 40% of the total wealth of the entire network. In effect, under 0.2% of the entire companies control 40% of the entire network. And this network poses, in my opinion, a huge risk to the global economy. And because what happens if one suffers, then they all will end up being adversely affected. One propagates the other. Now, that study was undertaken with a data set established prior to the economic crisis. Thus, as the financial crisis forced some banks to die, like Lehman Brothers, and others to merge, the super entity, the 147, would now be even more connected, more concentrated, more of a problem for all of us. I'm sure that you, if you listen to this program regularly or read the many articles we have posted every day, I put our own stimulus plan, what I call a populist stimulus plan, how we could put 15 million Americans to work, how we could gain about $4 trillion in new revenue streams, actually lower the taxes, but have one flat tax on corporate America, sales tax that is functional to the type of luxury item higher, basic necessities lower. And then, of course, a 7% sales tax on every single transaction in Wall Street, whether it's an algorithm or whether it's bonds, stocks. That is where we would have money. Now, that doesn't make anyone on Wall Street poor. They still continue to make massive amounts of profit. But then the key is you ban the trading in commodities essential to life, meaning no one can trade for a profit food, water, and oil, gas, and currencies, the things we all should share in common, because it gives those who have the power to control the fluctuation of money, it gives them undue influence, and they use it. So here we have the companies. These are the most powerful companies in the world. The companies are interlocked. Barclays, Capital Group Companies, FMR Corporation, AXA Corporation, State Street Corporation, JP Morgan Chase, UBS, Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, Bank of America, Mellon Corp, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Societe Generale, Bank of America, Lloyds, Lehman Brothers Holdings, Sun Life Financial, ING Group, BNP, and several others. But those are the top of the top. Now, what you didn't see in there were companies such as Apple that is capitalized, but as much as it's capitalized, it's not powerful because it does not have the people on there who are the world shakers and makers, the policy makers. In the United States, five banks control half of our entire economy. Let me repeat that again. Five banks control half the economy. JP Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs collectively hold $8.5 trillion in assets, which equals roughly 56% of the U.S. economy. Now, this data was according to central bankers at the Federal Reserve. And in fact, the assets under one audit showed that the largest banks amounted to 43% of the U.S. economy. And thus, the crisis has made the biggest banks even more powerful. And because the government invoked too big to fail, meaning that the big banks will be saved no matter what, because they are very important, the big banks have incentive to make continued and bigger risks because they will be bailed out in the end. Essentially, it's an insurance policy for criminal risk-taking behavior. The former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minnesota stated, quote, market participants believe that nothing has changed, that too big to fail is fully intact, end quote. Now, remember, market means the banking cartel or the super entity. Thus, they build new bubbles and buy government bonds, which is sovereign debt, making the global financial system increasingly insecure and at risk of a larger collapse than what took place in 2008. Now, I've stated on this program that the United States is completely, totally, 100% bankrupt. It's just that we're not willing to acknowledge that. Let's take a look at the global supra-government and the free market, because we keep hearing this president and his accolades say, yes, support the free market. Do they really understand what they're supporting? In December of 2011, Roger Altman, the former Deputy Secretary of the Treasury under the Clinton administration, wrote an article for the Financial Times in which he explained that financial markets were, quote, acting like a global supra-government, end quote. That means they are accountable to no one. In lay language, the top 20 U.S. corporations received almost $16 trillion in one secret bailout that was not even included in the quantitative easing or the initial bailout. These people have never been held accountable. None of their executives ever brought to justice. So why should you be concerned? And why should this president being reelected be anything other than a sense of joy? An exceptional sense of joy to the person such as Chris Matthews, who said that, you know, good that we had this storm. And when I heard him say that, I just thought, oh my goodness, clearly you're not considering that Obama's win, based upon how he looked during the storm, was more important than the people who suffered, the over the 110 who died, the 5 million who were hit, the hundreds of thousands of homes damaged or destroyed, the businesses closed, those who are without food and water. So that's the game? Anything to win? And thank God for the superstorm? That's the level of ethics of people like Chris Matthews and others on the left? That's your level of capital that you put into this? In the age of globalization, money, or we'll call it capital, flows across all borders with banks, hedge funds, equity partnerships, and other financial institutions. What they're doing, they're acting like a vanguard of a new international order of global governance. Where finance goes, corporations follow. Where corporations venture, power states stand guard of their interest. Our global system is one of state capitalism, where the state and corporate interests are interdependent and mutually beneficial, at least for those in power. Today, financial institutions with banks at the helm have reached unprecedented power and influence in state capitals, and the banks are bigger than ever in our history, and they're guarded by an insurance policy that we call too big to fail, which means that despite their criminal and reckless behavior, the government will step in and bail them out, as it always has. And they have no choice but to do, because they control the central banks, they control the Federal Reserve, they control the congressional seats, they control the White House, they control the media. They can reach their hand in anywhere with one of their advisors and one of their members and touch you. Now, if you're a critic, if you're a cynic, they'll touch you hard. If you're a supporter, they touch you nice. Financial markets also include credit rating agencies, which determine the supposed credit worthiness of other banks and corporations and entire nations. The lower the credit rating, the riskier the investment, and thus the higher the interest is for the entity to borrow, the riskier money. Countries that do not follow the dictates of the financial market are punished. How do they punish them? Give them a lower credit rating. Charge them a higher interest rate. Get involved in speculative attacks. Look at Greece. If you can remember back, I said a year ago with Gerald Celente, then 6 months ago, then 3 weeks ago, that Greece will fall, but not its corrupt, completely corrupt Congress, not its government. They will go along with austerity measures because they've been bought. But the people will protest. Well, tens of thousands protested over the last few days. And eventually, when these austerity measures are put into place fully, when jobs are cut, minimum wages eviscerated, pensions are slashed, the cost of everything goes up, the privatization, then the Greek people will have an out-and-out, full-blown revolution, and they will not throw them out of office. There's going to be anarchy. There's going to be They'll burn down Athens. That's what I predict. And then Italy will follow. Ireland is on the back burner. This is going to happen. And because no matter who they elect at this point, they're not going to have people that really represent the people, but rather represent, in the age of the super entity, the global supra-government. There's no time to rattle around in the pesky process of former liberal democracy. In their minds, they mean business. And if any of these people get their people elected, then they're going to creak market discipline. Screw the people. All power to the banks. So when you hear them talking about financial bailouts, understand that's not money going to the people. That's going back to the banks. Banks and financial institutions provide the liquidity or funds for what we call free markets. Free markets, in principle, would allow for free competition between companies and countries, each producing their own comparative advantage, producing what they are best at, and trading with others in the international market, so that all parties rise in living standards and become wealthier together. The free market is, of course, pure myth. It does not exist. There is no such thing. It never has been such a thing. In practice, what we call free markets are actually highly protectionist, regimented, regulated, and designed to undermine competition and enforce monopolization. The free markets serve this purpose for the benefit of large multinational corporations and banks. When we use the term free markets, we're generally referring to the real economy, legitimate and legal. When it comes to illegitimate markets, for example, the global drug trade, we do not tend to refer to them as free markets, but rather illegal and run by cartels. Well, cartels, like corporations, are hierarchically organized totalitarian institutions where decisions and power are exercised from the top down, with essentially no input going from the bottom up. Well, let me ask you something. When was the last time your senator, your House member, your president actually did what the people needed for the people's benefit? Can you name me such a time? If so, please do. I'd like to know. The act, our government acts, our legislators act, and certainly this present act, is if they are a member of a cartel. They seek to control their particular market through entire nations, regions, and beyond. Often, cooperation between corporations allow them to function in a power manner where the collective dominates the entire market, carving it up between them. Major oil companies, agro-industrial firms, telecommunications, pharmaceuticals, the media, military contractors, water management corporations are well-known cartels. I'm going to give you, in the time remaining, just one example of how bad it's been right in front of you, and not a single person was held accountable. Where if you or I engaged in money laundering, we would spend a decade in prison. In 2009, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime reported that billions of dollars in drug money saved the major banks during the financial crisis, providing much-needed liquidity. Antonio Maria Costa, the head of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, stated that drug money was, quote, the only liquid investment capital available to banks on the brink of collapse. Roughly $325 billion in drug money absorbed by the banking system. Without identifying specific countries or banks, he said, quote, the interbank loans were funded by money that originated from the drug trade and other illegal activities, end quote. In 2010, Wachovia Bank, now owned by Wells Fargo, settled the largest action ever under the U.S. Bank Secrecy Act, paying a fine of $50 million plus forfeiting $110 million of drug money, of which the bank had laundered $378 million out of Mexico alone. So let me get this straight. They had $378 billion with a B. They were given a $50 million penalty and not allowed to use $110 million of it. But if they made 5% on $378 billion, crime pays. The federal prosecutor in the case stated, quote, Wachovia's blatant disregard of our banking laws gave international cocaine cartels a virtual carte blanche to finance their operations, end quote. Well, the fine that the banks paid for laundering hundreds of billions of dollars in drug money was less than 2% of the bank's profit. And on the same week of the settlement, Wells Fargo's stock went up. The bank admitted in a statement of settlement that, quote, as early as 2004, Wachovia understood the risk of holding such an account, but despite these warnings, Wachovia remained in the business, end quote. The leading investigator in the money laundering operation, Martin Woods, based out of London, had discovered that Wachovia had received roughly 7,000 subpoenas for information about its Mexican operation from the federal government, of which Woods commented, quote, an absurd number. So at what point does someone at the highest level not get the feeling that something is very, very wrong? Woods had been hired by Wachovia's London branch as a senior anti-money laundering officer in 2005. And in 2006, an official investigation was opened into Wachovia's Mexican operations. Woods was informed by the bank that he failed, quote, to perform as an acceptable standard. In other words, he was doing a good job, but he found the money, found the illegal activity, and they fired him. As the former UN Office of Drugs and Crime czar, Costa said, quote, the connection between organized crime and financial institutions started in the 70s and early 80s when the mafia became globalized, just like other major markets. These are the proceeds of murder and misery in Mexico and of drugs sold around the world. Okay. All right. No one went to jail. Quote, what does this settlement do to the fight the cartels? Nothing. It doesn't make the job of law enforcement easier and encourages the cartels and anyone who wants to make money by laundering their blood dollars. Where's the risk? There is none. End quote. Quote, it is in the interest of the American people to encourage both the drug cartels and the banks in this way. Is it in the interest of the Mexican people? It's simply, if you don't see the correlation between the money laundering by the banks and 30,000 to 50,000 people killed in Mexico, you're missing the point. End quote. So, let me put the dot on this. The two big-to-fail banks, which supported this president and the Democratic Party, as well as the Republican Party, they support both sides, they are the ones engaged in drug laundering money. They're the ones who are engaged in illegal activities constantly. No one will go to jail. They control everything. They control our Justice Department. And look at the banks. Just look at the banks, quote, acted as financial services wing of the drug cartels, noting that HSBC, Britain's biggest bank, had been called before the U.S. Senate to testify about laundering drug money for Mexican cartels, holding one, quote, one suspicious account for 4 years on behalf of the largest drug cartel in the world, the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico. In fact, a multi-year investigation to HSBC revealed that the bank was not only a major international drug money laundering conduit, but also laundered money for clients with ties to terrorism, including helping the people in Saudi Arabia through their banks launder money for terrorists. So in conclusion, all we have is financial fraud, and they get a get out of jail free card. They end up putting it to the American people. They end up stealing billions from schools, hospitals, libraries, nursing homes, from virtually every state and district and territory in the United States, according to court documents, and yet they're not held accountable. The theft has been done through manipulation of the public bidding process, something that the mafia had become expert in regarding garbage and construction and industry contracts. In short, our entire banking system functions like a mafia cartel system, not to mention taking money from the mafia cartels themselves. Banks, I accuse J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and all of your employees. You are all engaged in criminal activity. You engage in bribery, fraud, conspiracies, which resulted in the bankruptcy of countries all across the counties all across the United States. Still, you continue to be respected by the media and by the power elites and by those in the Democratic Party. Shame on you. And then again, there is no shame there. And the entire political class, which refuses to punish them. So the next time you hear about one of these very wealthy individuals from one of these very wealthy companies standing up at Sotheby's and saying, for that Picasso, we are now $100 million, $100 million. Who's going to bid? And you see a paddle go up. And then you see a hush and someone then says, sold for $100 million. Well, you bought the painting and you can put it in your palace, apartment, penthouse, or co-op. But look at all of the crime that you engaged in order to get the money, and all the people who suffered died because of it. All the while, the American public are being lied to and fed crumbs. There is no reform. There will be no reform. There will be no change, whether you can believe it in or not, because the most powerful people who control everything, who selected these people, and we elected their people, and they were at the head of the LIBOR scandal. All these people, they have gotten away with crimes against humanity, and none of them will be held accountable. This is only a harbinger of austerity that will start in America. What you see in Greece, what you see in Ireland, what you see in Spain and Portugal, expect in the next 2 years, the same banking systems will put it to the American public. What will we do? Stay complacent? Distract ourselves? Or we will go to the street? I said it before, I'll say it again. Every single politician in the United States should be thrown out of office. Every single one. Until we challenge the system will continue to control us. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening.